Hello, everybody. Welcome into another episode of the Comics Experience Make Comics podcast, the show where we talk nuts and bolts of making comics. And this week we have a great guest to come on and talk about an upcoming seminar. Andy, do you want to introduce our guest?
Sure. Our guest this week is writer Kieran Gillen, who is well known for many great works, including Phonogram, but currently Wicked and Divine, Uber, Star Wars, Dr. Aphra. He's had great runs on Journey into Mystery and Uncanny X-Men. So here we are. We're going to talk with Kieran. And our shameless plug, I'm just going to go ahead and get this kind of out of the way. Kieran is going to do what we call a master seminar coming up on Saturday, November the 18th, which you can read about at comicsexperience.com. Click on our courses, and it's one of the first things that will pop up under the writing courses. And he's going to do a seminar for about 5 hours on that Saturday called Surviving Work for Hire. And we're going to go over, Kieran's going to go over a ton of really cool stuff. I'm sure lots of very fun stories, as well as being very informative. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. Kieran, welcome to the podcast.
Very glad to be here. It's of course quite late for me in the UK, so it's quite nice to actually come down from a hard day's worth of comic, hard days talking about comics, by talking some more comics. So that's good stuff.
good. Well, what I wanted to talk with you about, and obviously you know this because we emailed about it, but what our audience doesn't know is we're going to talk about preparation before going into a series, because I had offhandedly mentioned in an email the structure that you used going into the structure prep that you clearly did do going into your run on Journey into Mystery, which ran for 22, 23 issues, somewhere around that.
Yeah, it's complicated with the tie-ins, but yeah, about like somewhere, I think actually it was total 30 issues including tie-ins. So it's like most of my kind of runs I did for Marvel, all about 30 issues. It's kind of like, you know, Darth Vader was basically 30 issues. Uncanny was, Journey into Mystery was, Iron Man was. It's weird. I never actually hit 32 ever. It's like I noticed, like, we've just done that in WICDIV. It's like I have a kind of like sound barrier I couldn't get past.
Well, I'm sure you'll break it soon.
Yes, actually, Uber's broken it already. So yeah. Anyway, you were saying. Oh, sorry.
Well, yeah. Well, I remember that I had been reading a fair amount of your work at that point, but it was really with that series that I started to sort of see some, or think I was seeing some of what was kind of going on behind the scenes. And it seemed clear, and it's interesting you already brought up the tie-ins, but it seemed clear that even with the tie-ins that you had a clear roadmap for that series. And I'm sure when tie-ins show up, they send you off in places you weren't sure you were going to explore on that roadmap. What I was really kind of fascinated about and wanted to talk with you about was how much pre-planning you do for, you know, a longer run like that before you start, you know, writing page one, panel one.
Yeah, it's so tricky because I was sort of thinking about this earlier, in that the amount of pre-planning I do on a book is entirely dependent on the sort of book it is. As in, it's kind of like the work, and the work's always different. And in the case of Journey into Mystery, it was always the thing then. It was in a very set period of Work for Hire comics. I mean, it's kind of like some of the stuff we'll be talking about at the in the masterclass. But the idea is that, you know, in Work for Hire, there's not really one set of rules you learn. It's being able to actually see, okay, what's going on at the moment? What can I do to make my book less likely to be cancelled? What can I do to make this book good? And in the case of Journey to Mystery, I'd been at, you know, Marvel for a few years, and I felt I hadn't done a book I was, which was entirely had my stamp upon it, you know? So sure. I was pretty sure I was doing Uncanny and Journey to Mission at the same time, and I kind of had the idea that Uncanny was going to be this me playing the main stage at Glastonbury, you know, like the big kind of Springsteen thing. And Journey to Mystery was the kind of the weird cult band, you know. And the point is, okay, to do that, I've really got to make my own. So in other words, the main thing I had to think of: how can I do a plot which will hold together for 30 issues, which can also resist any crossover that appears. That's kind of the two things. So that's so much of the pre-planning was actually about the crossovers. As in, I didn't know what crossovers would be, but I knew they would be there because, you know, you could see that every other book that was happening has a crossover every second arc, you know?
Right.
So in the case of Journey to Mystery, at least part of it was thinking about that. As in, you know, okay, look at the industry, what's going on, what do I need to survive? And in the case of, like, like a novel structure like Journey to Mystery, where the first issue very clearly sets up the last issue. It's like, okay, let's see the structure of it all. For me, so you had to sit back and go, okay, the larger scale thing, and what is this story? What is the story's themes? What are you trying to say? And yeah, this is probably the writing thing. Most, you know, that, you know, sticking on a post-it note the theme of your story and sticking on the wall, just so you can always be aware of what's this story actually meant to be doing, so you don't lose yourself in the rainforest. In the case of Journey to Mystery, it's like, okay, I need to work out a structure that is robust enough to survive. In that case, it's like, it's the story about, you know, there will be a logical emotional continuation as Loki tries to, you know, prove he's a good person. There's a phrase that a critic used was Ponzi scheme heroism, in that every kind of victory was based upon clearly something that's going to go wrong later. And it is constantly putting it off. And that's kind of the structure of raising tension. And I kind of knew, okay, the basic story is that it's getting to the point near the end when there's going to be a major disaster. The major disaster will reach a climax. Loki will actually clear to be halfway through, you think Loki's gone bad again. No, he hasn't. He's actually good. And at the end of that, the second major threat, which I've set up, comes into play. In the case of Journey to Mystery, those threats end up being Surta, who's a character I never pronounce. Surta reforging like these satanic machines. It's kind of like the Industrial Revolution turned satanic, like literally the dark satanic mills. And the other threat was this fear crown made by Mephisto. And they are made in the first, and these kind of set up in these two separate arcs. And I kind of knew that like one of them would be the last storyline. And it could be like Loki discovers Mephisto has this fear crown that can now allows him to basically overpower the entire universe. He has to stop him. So the entire arc could have been that. And then in the last issue, Surta's threat appears and he realizes, oh no, when I've been saving the world from Mephisto, Surta's took it over. And there's no way for me to now win. The only way for me to win is to actually sell out to my old self. So you know what I mean? In terms of actually planning for that kind of run, it was about, okay, what is the largest possible structure whose details I do not presently know? I mean, the case, like, at the same time, I was also aware the book could have been cancelled on issue 7. Because many books, you know, lasted for like an arc and a half. So it could just have tied into the fear itself. So in other words, it basically existed. Its first, like, ended up being 10 issues, was originally planned as 7, dovetailed issue by issue with a major crossover. In that kind of, I'm trying to look at what the actual Matt was writing and what's the best way to get synergy between these two books whilst, of course, entirely subverting them. As I mentioned previously, my planning is based around I'm writing a novel, unfortunately, and I'm doing it at the background of someone else's book at the same time. So that, you know what I mean? A lot of the planning there, especially early on, was kind of how can I specifically do that and then leave a kind of waypoints in the future. It's best. Right. You know what I mean? I said, like, I know there's a mountain over there and there's a mountain over there, and as long as I build these two bits of machinery, the plot will work. You know, so you step back and see what is the story, and then you kind of build, make sure there is time for you to build the pieces that go in there.
Right. And I think, sort of just to kind of clarify some of the terms as I've been using them, you know, I've been talking about structure, and I think sometimes when I say structure, people think I mean like plot structure or plot mechanics, but I'm kind of using that term a little bit differently. So it sounds to me like you kind of said, I know what my character arc is going to be. I know what my theme is going to be. I know what is going to challenge my character, what types of things need to challenge my character in order to get him to where he needs to be for the climax of his story. And then you said from a plotting standpoint, like you were saying, I need these two things. I need to set these two things up, and once I've kind of got those cooking, I can use whatever might, you know, whether it's a crossover or whatever that might come into the book, and I can tie that in thematically with what my character needs to go through, and that way you can make the whole thing work to get to the end. Does that sound about right?
Oh yeah, that was exactly right. It's kind of that's kind of at least some way how I end up, like I say, protecting it from the problems of crossovers, in that kind of any crossover story can be a useful element, because like as long as I'm thinking about how does this affect Loki, you know, and it's normally like him solving things in the worst possible way, and by the fact he solves the stuff in the worst possible way means it can always come back at him. You know, as in, like, everything becomes right. So every team up he makes is essentially a double cross down the line. So it's that kind of, that is the most resilient nature of it, and that's absolutely it. As in, as long as you kind of know what the story is, and what the story is isn't like, and then the orcs attacked Mordor or whatever. You know, that's kind of like, you can always imagine, like, I've got a map of Middle Earth on my wall, and I occasionally look at the bit going south from Hobbiton, and it's like, you know, why did they, you know, what would happen if they Frodo just went south? You know, as in, like, if the fellowship, instead of going across the mountain and through Moria, just like, forget it, I'm going down this way, because there's all this stuff over here, it looks pretty flat. And of course, what would have happened is Tolkien would have made a different set of adventures, and it would also express, you know, Frodo's journey. You know what I mean? As in, the Frodo is much more important than the plot per se, because the plot only really matters for me insofar it's the thing that makes the reasons for the characters to make decisions. You know, all things which conflict the characters, or things that express the characters. I mean, it is kind of, the other part of planning is like world building. You know, and I was chatting, I was having problems on a project I put on the back burner now and doing something else. But I had a really interesting world. I liked it a lot, and it was just dead. I couldn't, you know, I was not getting anywhere. And I was chatting to, I was on a panel with Marjorie Lowe, and she was talking about her problem with Monstrous, and that she was similarly dead until she realized she didn't really have a reason to be there. You know, and essentially she had to get the lead character, and then that lead character travels to the world. And that's the only thing that really matters about the world is the lead character. You know, the external environment is a mirror of the internal environment, and it's designed to challenge them. So in other words, you know, it's, you can't really do Lord of the Rings. You don't until you have your Frodo. Does it make sense? In that kind of, like, you know, especially if you're doing like something much smaller and less world building than Lord of the Rings, the only, you actually find out who is going to go through these adventures is so much of the structure, because then the structure will present itself based upon that character. I mean, if you're working in something more like a movie, like an hour and a half movie, that's a different sort of structural writing. But if you're doing something that's a little bit more freeform, like a monthly comic book, the kind of like, oh no, the character is the thing we need to hold on to, and I need to be adaptable to what I see along the journey. And that's kind of the planning I, you know, did on Wicked Divine, where I've basically, there's the Journey to Mystery big plot beats, as in at the end of the first arc, this happens. At the end of the second arc, this happens. And these are the kind of like the big, heavy, crunchy plot things, and they kind of tie into Laura's journey for the book. At the same time, all the 12 gods have their own story arc. So like, and that there, the stuff I improvise with, is that kind of, shall I bring Balin, Bol's, you know, shall I bring in a secret of a certain character in early? Shall I bring it late? And how does it best express and dovetail with the rest of the plot? And that's kind of, that gives you the ultimate level of flexibility, but also you cannot, in a project that takes you 7 years, plan it like you would an hour and a half movie, because you will die of boredom. You know what I mean? That's so much about the idea, the structure. You know, I made Journey to Mystery structure resilient, but I also made it fun. In that kind of, there's always a writing challenge for me to sit down and enjoy. If you plan it out all at the beginning, A, you're going to be immediately disrupted by the challenges along the way, but B, it's also going to be quite tedious.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, from my perspective, when I was on staff as an editor at Marvel, and then this was also true when I was at IDW working on different kinds of franchises, you know, what I learned, I didn't know this on day one, but I learned it pretty quickly, was when writers came in and they had these plots, you know, these story points where, you know, then they turn left and then the gang from New York does this, that was when we wound up getting into trouble, because, you know, in Daredevil, that gang got wiped out and we didn't know that was coming, you know. And we had I remember one of the things that was interesting, I was editing X Factor and we had a character, Siren, Banshee's daughter, in there, and I wasn't in the X-Men office. I was actually in the Marvel Heroes office, and I didn't really, you know, think after a year of editing X Factor, like, I should go in and make sure Banshee's not getting killed in the X-Men. And so I found out the day that Banshee, you know, I found out the day the comic was on stands in stores that Banshee was killed. And just the other editor and I just didn't, like, you know, it just didn't occur to one of us, you know. I mean, we're friends, there was nothing wrong going on there, but and so then I went down to the editor's office, so I was like, did Banshee just die? And then called up, he was writing it, called him up, let him know, and then he was able to go, okay, well then how do we, you know, we're not gonna be able to address this for several months. So how do we address it? And then that wound up leading to a storyline, but that led to a storyline in a very odd way, because he was looking at Siren and saying, well, she's seen how many people die and come back, so she's just in denial. And that was how we started dealing with it, was she just never brought it up with anybody because she just assumes he's coming back. Which was a very comic booky way to handle it, but it was, you know, sort of a little bit, you know, not quite breaking the fourth wall, but it was a fun way to handle it. But it's the same sort of concept as, is, you know, when the writers that I worked with would get too tied down into the plot mechanics, that was when we wound up in trouble. But when we would talk about characters and what was going to challenge the characters and how we were going to put them through the ringer, we were able to weather just about any storm that way, which is really, you know, what you're talking about. And you know, it's become my favorite way to work. And now that I kind of do my own, create our own books, I don't have to worry about, you know, continuity coming into play quite as much. But yeah, this is fascinating stuff. So when on Wicked and Divine, I just want a point of contrast on Wicked and Divine or one of your creator own books, it doesn't exist in a universe where these outside forces are going to be as powerful or potentially disruptive. Do you do any, you know, I'm sure it's different because every project is different, but do you find that you dive more into plot and kind of tamp that down a little bit more, or do you follow a very similar approach on those?
I would
books?
Say, like, when I started it, you know, and it's a very dangerous mystery in that the first issue will dictate the last issue. You know, it's designed to be like Journey into Mystery if it didn't have to worry about crossovers, as you say. So Wickdiv is so much more complicated than anything I've ever written. And that's always sounds like arrogant, but I just mean that there is just so many moving parts. It's kind of like my Watchmen fetishism comes into play in terms of, like, oh no, I really want to design this magnificent machine. And that's kind of, there was a bit in Young Avengers which was kind of like that, but that equally in Young Avengers was designed so to be short enough to be no crossovers. You know, this is probably something that's worth talking in the masterclass a bit, but that kind of, like, I think 15 issues is about as long as anyone can go without having a crossover if you have a book of a certain kind. So that story structure dictated that. And so that experience plus Jim's experience became Wicked in that. So on one level, like, every arc when I start is pretty well planned. Like, and the synopsis for an issue is as long as most people's synopsis for an arc. And so I kind of vibe, as in, like, it's pretty broken down. When I write it changes, and it changes pretty severely. But so at the start of every arc, it becomes a document of, like, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 words I'll send to Jamie. I mean, I've just sent Jamie and Chrissy, who's Wicked's editor, the plan for the final year of Wicked, like the last 12 issues. And that's like 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 words. You know, that's the kind of like 1,500 words an issue. But that's kind of because Wicked is so complicated. And I didn't have that level of planning at the start for the final year. If that makes any sense?
So words, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, so you're refining and you're detailing in as you go, which means that probably the way that you planned it, even the number of issues that it's going to run is going to be significantly different than if you look back at that original document that you had. You're going to wind up ending basically, my guess is, basically where you figured you would end up, but how you got there, like you said, you instead of going up the mountain when you thought you would, maybe you realize that actually we're going to go down into this valley over here instead.
Yeah. It's a bit like I'm working on a new project for Image at the moment called codename Spangly New Project. So it's kind of interesting doing my first post Wicked like larger project in that what I'm keeping and what I'm changing, and, you know, because I don't want to do the same book again. But there is at least part of it in terms of, like, the end of trade cliffhanger is my basic structural unit, and at the start of Wicked I had that, as in, like, I could, like, you know, I knew having at the end of the first trade, end of the second trade, end of the third trade, end of the fourth trade, end of the sixth trade, as I didn't know having the end of the fifth, because the entire third year was meant to be like a double album. Mm-hmm. So, like, I knew a lot of stuff that happened there, and then I know happened at the end of the book as well. Actually, what the end of the seventh trade is actually what I didn't realise. I must admit, structurally speaking, I probably have guessed. But that's the one that came. But kind of what happened inside those arcs is completely and utterly changed. You know, radically changed.
Right.
And
yeah.
It's more like, there's a game called Microscope. It's a pen and paper game. And it's basically, it's a world building game. And it starts with the basic structure of the game is you get little cards and you write stuff on the cards. And so this game would be about, say, let's say this is about the age of, the rise of the Kingdom of Dragons. And you write on the front of the first card, Rise of Kingdom of Dragons. And on the second card, you would write, Dragons Consumed by Ice Beasts at the End of the Empire, or whatever. And you put them both down, and then the players basically take turns of putting another card between them. or either between them, which of course creates more detail to the story, or downwards from the event. So you might put an event in the middle saying the rising of the Crystal Castle or something like that. And that means, okay, the Dragon Empire started, then the Crystal Castle happened, and then towards the end, then the Ice People turned up. And then someone else might put a card saying, only the Golden Dragon's got to live in the Crystal Castle. And you carry on like that. That's kind of a bit like what it's like writing in terms of the large structural beats are there, but you get to fill in all the details beneath it. That's at least my kind of mode for writing long form ongoing comics. And that's kind of useful because it's the maximum amount. There's a backbone there, so you know where you're going. But there's like the closer you look, the more fractal it is. And that's the same, I think, in any artistic project.
Now I want to play that game.
I've never actually played it. I've read the rules, but it's like sitting there. It's like if you play Fiasco, get playing like these sort of games with like writers. Right. It's fun in this kind of like you go, uh oh, this is just our jobs.
Yeah, we did a thing in our an online creators workshop in addition to the courses and the seminars, and we had guys do a thing called the round robin comic, where like everybody would write, one person would write a page and then hand it off and to somebody else who would write the next page and then hand it off to somebody else, you know, and so on and so forth, and then they kind of go back through and see how it hangs together. It's really it's not the same thing, obviously, because this was done in a linear fashion, but it was a really interesting experiment, and like everybody that participated in it kind of came away having learned just a ton about storytelling and building their confidence, because they learned that they can just pick up a story and they can add on to it. And they could start to identify themes that may not have been planned, but they start to present themselves over time and then play off of them. It was pretty fascinating. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer. Thank you very much for your time to come on to the podcast, and we are looking forward to spending a whole day with you coming up in just a couple of weeks. Again, that master seminar with Kieran is on surviving work for hire. You're going to get tons more stories like we've discussed here today. Kieran's planned out a whole structured thing for it, and you can read about it at comicsexperience.com. Click on the courses, on the writers, on the writing courses, and it'll pop right up, and you can see if that's something to register for. And that is November 18th. So I think that's it from my end. Again, Kieran, thank you. Joey, thank you, of course, also.
Oh, thank you for having me. That's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like this will be a great kickoff pitch for, what is it, Golden Dragons and Crystal Castles? I think that's
I laugh, so I immediately go to like really pulp fantasy. It's
like... No, it sounded great. It was a terrific example. And Kieran, where should folks check you out online? Is Twitter the best place to find you?
Twitter's good. I run a Tumblr. Basically, if you enter Kieran Gill, you'll find most of my stuff. I'm on Twitter. That's a good place to find me. But my Tumblr, I do a lot of writing there, and I do writer's notes for my books and stuff. So that's enter my name, and you'll probably find me.
Excellent. Well, thanks. Thanks again.
And also check out Kieran's podcast, Decompressed, which is a really fantastic podcast on the craft of comics.
Terrific. Yes. Terrific listen. Really great listen.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I need to do some more.
if only you had had time with all the writing, and we appreciate you staying late with us tonight. I know it's a little bit later.
My pleasure. Great being here.
Excellent. All right. Well, if you have a question or a topic you'd like to hear talked about on the show, you can always email info@comicsexperience.com, or you can tweet Comic Experience on Twitter. And until next time, keep making comics.